Good morning. This is Commute and Compute. I am your host, Contra, and this is episode 29. And today, on our way in, I want to dive into something a little fascinating, maybe unsettling, and it's really just diving into the intersection of technology, finance, and our everyday lives. But mainly finance. And we're going to be mulling over a concept essentially that first glance seems, well, normal, but upon closer inspection, I think reveals a surprisingly complex and troubling side. We're going to talk about normalcy as a form of governance, particularly in the realm of finance, and how it impacts our human rights. You know, it reminds me of that classic line from Alice in Wonderland. You know, Alice, in her own whimsical way, says, "If I had a world of my own, everything would be nonsense. Nothing would be what it is, because everything would be what it isn't." And in Wonderland, she finds a world that truly has freed itself from our usual definitional frames. A world where, you know, hats speak riddles, cats give advice, and communicating solely in poems is perfectly acceptable. It's a world that highlights the inherent subjectivity of what we as humans, I think, define as normal. And that's where things get tricky, isn't it? Because if normal, quote unquote, is so subjective, then applying that frame of normalcy and governance, particularly in something as fundamental as finance, becomes a really delicate balancing act. And when governance imposes an understanding of what is normal, it inevitably, and perhaps unintentionally, denies the governed the free expression of what they deem to be normal. And that, my friends, is where our human rights can start to feel a little squeezed. So let's take a closer look at this concept of normalcy as governance, specifically in the financial world. And every single day, as we go about our lives, AI-driven algorithms are diligently sifting through hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of bank transactions. Their goal? To flag activity that falls outside of a predefined normalcy cluster. This, we're told, is all in the name of preventing financial crime. Sounds good on the surface, right? Who wants financial crime? But then if you dig a little deeper and the picture starts to get a bit less clear, I think. For instance, did you know that in the U.S., spending or receiving more than $10,000 in cash is automatically deemed unnormal or even suspicious? I mean, even in in Europe, that threshold can plummet as low as 3,000 euros. And think about that for a moment. You sell your old car for cash, or maybe a used boat, or even a luxury bag to make some extra money. The moment you deposit that cash into your bank account, you inadvertently find yourself in a government database and potentially on law enforcement's radar. And these are called currency transaction reports, or CTRs. And it doesn't stop there. Banks are also mandated to file what are known as suspicious activity reports, or SARs. These are triggered when your transactions deviate from your known transaction behavior. You know, imagine a person working minimum wage who suddenly deposits $9,000 because they finally sold their beat up, you know, car. Or someone sending money to a family they met while couch surfing, you know, in Morocco. These seemingly innocuous, perfectly legitimate activities can trigger a suspicious activity report. The frameworks governing all this flagging are collectively known as anti-money laundering or AML laws. And when an AML system flags your activity as unnormal, there are real-life consequences. First, a compliance officer at your bank will draft a report, transmitting it to a country's financial intelligence unit. Bet you didn't even know those existed. The government body, you know, responsible for fighting financial crime, that is. Quote-unquote fighting, right? And this report, along with all your personal details, then becomes available to law enforcement for investigative leads. They might choose to open an investigation into you, or they may not. But regardless, you know, your personal information is now indefinitely stored in a giant government database, ready for potential future use, essentially forever. Now, here's a crucial point, and one that I find particularly concerning, as if those other points weren't concerning enough. You know, AML flagging systems are typically turned to maximum sensitivity. And what does that mean? It means banks are drastically over-reporting activity to the government. And why is that? Because governments rarely penalize banks for actual money laundering slipping through the cracks. Instead, they penalize banks for lacking adequate anti-money laundering programs. The more people slip through their system, the higher the fine for the bank. So what do the banks do? They play it safe. They cast a wide net, and sometimes even an incredibly wide net, because it's a lot cheaper for them to overreport than to risk a hefty fine from the government. This practice, along with, you know, the subsequent account closures, is known as CYA, or cover your ass, right? They have to cover their ass. And once an AML program flags you for unnormal behavior, your bank will likely close your account. Not because you've been accused of a crime, or even misconduct for that matter. They simply exercise their right to no longer service you as a customer. They don't want to bear the risks or the costs of continuing essentially to offer you their services, quote-unquote services. And here's truly the insidious part, is they don't have to tell you why. Think about that for a second. This widespread reporting and the resulting surveillance directly impacts our freedoms, because there's very little we can express without spending money. Everything from purchasing, you know, a train ticket, to attending a protest, to buying a book about, say, you know, the Cuban Revolution, to simply even enjoy a meal at your favorite, you know, restaurant down the street. All of these seemingly innocent everyday activities can be tracked, analyzed, and potentially misinterpreted by the program. You know, you bought a train ticket to a protest, the police might just pay you a visit tomorrow. Buying that book, congrats. You know, you might find yourself on a government watch list. You love that, you know, Syrian food, right? You might just be labeled a terrorist sympathizer. And if you do fall victim to this AML flagging, what can you do? And here's another shocking reality. Disclosing why your bank closed your account or simply flagged you due to suspicion of, you know, money laundering is deemed a felony in close to all jurisdictions around the world. So even if your bank wanted to tell you why, they can no longer serve you or give you the opportunity to resolve the dispute. They're officially barred from doing so. And this secrecy is a huge problem. It means banks don't have to fear retaliation from, you know, former customers, making them much more likely to close accounts fast and frequently. And this, my friends, is where we start to see a clear path to political censorship. While many of us are aware that those, you know, holding, you know, unfavorable political views might face censorship from platforms, both online and real life, AML laws are increasingly being abused to silence those who become uncomfortable to the establishment. We've seen it even in the WikiLeaks, right? We've seen it with individuals connected to the Trump family. And heartbreakingly, we've seen it with those protesting for fundamental, you know, human rights or civil liberties. And what makes these AML laws such an incredibly efficient tool for political censorship is simple, really. Money is at the very heart of the society we live in. Oversight of our bank account gives governments incredibly granular insight into our political affiliations or our medical histories and, you know, God forsake, even our sexual preferences. And the control over who can access the global financial system, well, that bears the power to effectively end a person's ability to exercise any of their other rights guaranteed by both, you know, national and international law. From the freedom of movement to the freedom to, you know, express yourself. It's a chokehold on your very existence within the modern world. So this brings us to a critical question then. What are the alternatives? How can we reclaim our financial sovereignty and protect our human rights, you know, in a system that seemingly increasingly is designed for surveillance and control? And this is where the world of Bitcoin and the emergency ecosystem of Nostr, I think, becomes incredibly relevant. And let's talk about Bitcoin first, right? Bitcoin was born out of the 2008 financial crisis, arguably even before then. But it was a direct response to a system that many felt was opaque, centralized, and prone to abuse, which it was. You know, at its core, Bitcoin is decentralized digital currency. What does decentralized mean in this context? Well, it means there's no single central authority, no government, no bank that controls it. Transactions are recorded, again, for those who are unaware, on a public ledger called the blockchain. And it's maintained by a network of computers around the world, or nodes. And this public, transparent, and immutable record is a radical departure from the opaque, centralized nature of traditional finance. And when you transact in Bitcoin, you're not asking permission from a bank or government. You're transacting directly with another individual, peer-to-peer. And this fundamentally changes the dynamic. There's no bank to file a SAR report on you for, you know, unnormal activity. There's no $10,000 cash, you know, threshold that flags you. And while Bitcoin, you know, transactions are recorded on a public ledger, the identities of the participants are pseudo-anonymous, meaning they're represented by a string of numbers and letters, not your real name. Of course, there are ways to link real-world, you know, identities to Bitcoin addresses, and privacy is a spectrum, but the fundamental architecture of Bitcoin prioritizes individual autonomy and resistance to censorship, you know, in a way that traditional finance simply cannot. You know, imagine a world where protesting for human rights doesn't mean your bank account could be frozen or closed. Imagine a world where we're buying a book on a controversial topic doesn't put you, you know, on a watch list. Bitcoin, with its censorship-resistant nature, offers a glimpse into that possibility. It's not a magic bullet, and it has its own challenges, but, you know, I think it represents a powerful tool for financial freedom. And then we have Nostr. Now, Nostr, for those unfamiliar, stands for notes and other stuff transmitted by relays. It's a truly fascinating open protocol for decentralized social networking. You know, think of it as Twitter, but without a central company controlling the platform, without a, you know, a single point of censorship, and without a single point of failure. And you, at this point, you're probably asking yourself, how does Nostr tie into all of this? Well, if financial censorship is on one side of the coin, information censorship is on the other. The ability for the establishment to control narratives and silence dissenting voices through traditional social media platforms is a massive problem. We've all seen that over the last few years, right? And Nostr, I think, offers a way to bypass this. then in OnNoster, you know, your identity is based on a public and private key pair similar to Bitcoin. You connect to relays, which are like independent servers that store and broadcast messages. And anyone can run a relay. If one relay decides to censor you, you can simply connect to another. There's no central authority, essentially, to ban you from the entire network. And this is incredibly powerful for free expression. Now, where do Bitcoin and Noster intersect in a way that's particularly helpful for human rights and the view on finance? Well, they offer parallel paths to disintermediate, I think, the powerful centralized entities that can and do impose, you know, normalcy as governance. You know, imagine using Noster to organize a protest for human rights. The platform itself is censorship resistant, meaning your messages and calls to action are less likely to be suppressed. And then imagine, you know, receiving or sending funds for that protest or for individuals in need, you know, using Bitcoin where those transactions are also censorship resistant. And this combination creates a powerful ecosystem for individuals and groups to communicate, organize, transact outside the reach of traditional financial and informational systems. It's about building parallel systems, alternative pathways that are more aligned with individual freedom and human rights. For example, you can send zaps, small amounts of Bitcoin, or sats, the smallest unit of Bitcoin, directly to content creators you appreciate, to support causes, or to tip people for valuable information. This is micropayments for content, outside, you know, the traditional banking system. No bank flagging your unnormal tips, right? No PayPal freezing your account for sending money to someone with a controversial opinion. It's direct peer-to-peer and censorship resistant. This also, I think, relates back to the idea of covering your ass, right? You know, from the bank's perspective. If you're regularly transacting in Bitcoin directly from your own self-custodied wallet, you're operating outside of the purview of these AML systems. You're not generating CTRs or SARs. None of these reports are flagging you or generating on your activity. Your activity, by its very nature, is not being funneled into these government databases that are being stored in clouds forever. So it's definitely a complex and evolving landscape, for sure. You know, Bitcoin and Noster are not, you know, without their challenges and learning curves. I get that. But when we look at the trajectory of normalcy as governance and traditional finance and the very, you know, human rights implications of that trajectory, these decentralized technologies offer a beacon of hope. They represent tools that can, you know, empower individuals, protect privacy, and, you know, resist censorship. And I think over the next few episodes, I'm going to dive into, you know, how anti-money laundering measures can affect our everyday lives, using the the UN Convention on Human Rights as our guiding star. I think that'd be helpful, because ultimately this isn't just about finance or technology. It's about fundamental human dignity, the right to express ourselves, to associate freely, and ultimately to live our lives without constant surveillance, you know, and the threat of financial exclusion. It's about asking ourselves, what kind of world do we want to live in? And I'm asking you, what kind of world do you want to live in? Do we want a world where every financial transaction is scrutinized and potentially used against us? Or do we want a world where individuals have the freedom to transact and express themselves without the fear of, you know, being unnormal by some AI algorithm? It's something definitely worth mulling over on your commute or whatever you're doing while you're listening to this. Thank you for joining me on this episode. You can find links in the show notes to my Noster account. I'll leave my my NPUB in there as well. Download the Nostr app. Primal, Damis, Amethyst. They're on different Apple and Google Play Store that you can buy or get these apps for free and start testing these things for yourself. So next episode, I think we'll continue this important conversation. Until then, keep commuting, keep computing, and keep thinking for yourselves. I appreciate you guys for listening. Hope this was helpful. Share this, like it, follow me, send me some zaps, keep me motivated. Until then, stay free, stay sovereign. I'm Contra. I'm out.